Hi, I'm Michael Rappaport.
And I'm Kibi Rappaport.
And together we're hosting Rappaport's Reality Podcast.
We have a passion for reality TV, and we're inviting you into our living room.
We're dissecting the drama, and we're giving praise to the single greatest form of entertainment on television today. That is right. Reality TV is the greatest form of entertainment on television today.
Listen to Rappaport's Reality with me, Kibi Rappaport.
And me, Michael Rappaport, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.
Hey, I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go, right? There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. On NPR's new podcast, Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's part existential deep dive and part game show. I ask actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to ask some of life's biggest questions. Listen to NPR's Wildcard on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, this is Kurt Woodsmith. You remember me from such TV comedies as That 70s Show and That 90s Show on Netflix. I'll never forget the words that my grandfather said just before he kicked the bucket. He said, "Watch how far I can kick this bucket." People ask me where I get my dad jokes from. I tell them to listen to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast. Listen to Daily Dad Jokes every day on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, this is Dana Schwartz, and this is Popcorn Book Club from iHeartRadio. This week, we're jumping into a story of sadness and tragedy and mental illness. You know, just some light summer reading. It's I Know This Much Is True from Wally Lamb, which was an Oprah's book club pick and is now an HBO series starring two Mark Ruffalos, or Ruffali, as a pair of identical twins. Double Ruffalo!
Before we go into the rest of the book, can we just all say our favorite Ruffalos? My Ruffalo of preference is from Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
The glasses!
A good yeah. Ruffalo.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a solid Ruffalo.
Welcome to Popcorn Book Club. I am your host, Dana Schwartz, and I am joined, as always, by co-hosts Karan Madankwa, Tien Tran, Jennifer Wright, and Melissa Hunter. How are you guys doing, Karama? How are you doing?
Medium. I think the book is very sad and the world is very sad, but I actually got a new bookmark that helps.
Ooh, what's
it's
the
got
bookmark?
Sunflowers on it. Love yeah, it. Hold on. I'll show
oh,
you guys.
That's nice. And your dress is also sunflowered, which I really
yes,
love.
Yes, I was very sunflowery today.
Ooh, very, very
my friend
nice.
Made this for me bookmark. And mailed it to me.
Tien, how's your life in quarantine at the moment?
Pretty good. It's nice to escape to a sad book from a sad world. So that's been really fun. I also got a new bookmark.
Wow.
Not as cool as yours. And by God, I mean rifled in my desk for it. But it's star stickers.
Ooh. That's like a third of a bookmark.
Those are nice stars.
That is a very like mini bookmark. I love it. Economizing.
Mm-hmm. It's I love all things tiny.
Mm-hmm. Jennifer, you're zooming in from South Carolina, but it looks like you're against like a tropical background. Is it as are you just like basking in sunlight? What is the weather there? Because it looks like it's like 80 and perfect.
It's 86 degrees here, so it's a little bit mm-hmm. too hot. But yeah, it's also it's a sad week. I feel a little bad that I recommended a really sad book, not anticipating how sad the world was going to get.
You know what? I actually sometimes think that sadness in a fictional universe can be weirdly cathartic sometimes. Mm. It like if I'm feeling sad, I want to listen to sad songs and mm-hmm. I don't, you know what I mean? Like, I think it would be, mm-hmm. maybe I'm just justifying, but like, if I was reading like a very happy book about like people going about their happy lives, I would be like, what's your problem? I hate you. Melissa, how about you? How are you doing?
Yeah. You know, a solid, relatively fine, I feel like is the way I describe how I am every day. Like, relative to the rest of the world, I'm very fine. But yeah, everything's on fire and everything in this book makes me cry. I think we don't need to get into the book yet, but the first chapter I like read right before bed and I was like nope, can't do that again. That was a hard pass of a before bed book. So, yeah, but otherwise it's okay. Getting outside, got outside a lot this week, which was really nice, but stayed away from people who were being very irresponsible. It almost like, I feel like some of the irresponsible people ruin the nature that I'm trying to absorb to make me happy, you know?
Yes, yeah. 100%. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that is a very good segue into what we're reading this week. Wally Lamb's I Know This Much Is True, which was sort of like a hit at the time, you know, number one New York Times bestseller, Oprah Book Club, and now is being adapted on HBO with Double Ruffalo.
A double ruff.
Yes. A tale of two Ruffalos.
A tale of two Ruffalos. Too rough, too low.
That's actually good. I like that one.
I like that one.
And we're reading, we read chapters 1 through 15. So if you're following along at home, that's where we cut off. And obviously there's going to be no spoilers past that point because I haven't read past that. So if any of you have, please don't spoil anything.
I have not. My mom was like, you should, because everyone else is going to. I think that explains a lot about my life.
I almost did. I started reading chapter 16 and then I realized I would have gotten too confused because it jumps so much in time that I'm like, oh, I don't know if this bad thing happened or this bad thing happened, you know?
Well, thank you, Melissa. Now I owe my mother money.
That is exactly it, though, where it's like this book isn't linear in its plot, really. There mm-hmm. is one quote-unquote present day that carries us through, but we're jumping back in time to find out about the story and the childhood of our protagonist, Dominic Birdsey, and his identical twin brother, Thomas Birdsey, who is a diagnosed paranoid schizophrenic. And at the start of the book, Melissa, you wanna dive into what the sort of the major inciting incident is?
I'm sorry to put you on the spot. What gave me very vivid nightmares that night? That thing that happened?
Yeah, that's why I'm putting you on the spot.
Yeah. So, Thomas Birdsey, Dominic's brother, goes to a library, and he takes out a sword that he got from his stepfather and chops off his own hand and sutures it immediately, like finds a way to stop the bleed. But he does it in protest of the Gulf War. Yeah. And he does it. He's sacrificing his own hand, which is based on scripture, like a something that he's sort of decided is telling him through scripture and through God that he must do. And terrifies a lot of people in the library. Understandably.
And terrifies a lot of readers.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think I would be very afraid if I were in a public library somebody cut their own hand off.
Oh, yes.
And then immediately.
He throws it out into the middle of the library. Like, if you were running and you saw a hand just drop to the ground. You'd run the fuck out of there.
But you know what? If this book had taken place a little bit before when normal people took place, people would have thought they were being punked. People would have been like, Ashton?
But yeah, no, that is, it's a visceral, terrifying scene that is written about in such detail, like that he like tied the arteries to staunch the bleeding. And someone in we have a group chat, but someone said, and I don't remember, so I'm very sorry, said that they, for a moment, like thought it was a memoir because it is written.
Oh, that's me. Yeah. That's me.
It is. It's written so vividly.
I am an idiot who fully believed that this was a memoir.
I thought so too. Yeah.
I was like, you know what would be interesting? What would be interesting for book club is I could look up some of the newspaper reports on the time covering this, because obviously they would cover the man who chopped off his hand to try to stop the Gulf War. And I was so confused by the fact that I couldn't find any reporting from that time.
And then I found out.
I mean, the CIA was probably behind it. Like, I've learned from Thomas now that that they were covering it up. No, Wally Lamb is, I was very relieved to find out, an author of fiction, which apparently did not register in my brain. And he has a bunch of sisters and teaches incarcerated women how to write their life stories in a very inspiring way and has a very happy marriage
Wally.
And three Wally loving children. Wally is a good man having a rough life.
Mm-hmm. And I also do really like, I do want to say, like, when you write about mental health, especially in fiction, it's so often, like, sensationalized. And yes, cutting off your own hand is like a, it is sort of like if it bleeds, it leads, like sort of that it fits into that mode of like, oh, exploitative storytelling where it's like, oh, it's dramatic and attention grabbing. But I did appreciate that Wally Lamb, the author, did have like a disclaimer at the beginning talking about his process and his research. He has a list of like a bibliography at the end of the book of his sources that he consulted. And also, I think statistically, he represents the fact that most mentally ill people are a threat to themselves far more than they are a threat to other people.
Yeah.
Which I think is a nuance that isn't often portrayed in fiction.
Well, you know what's interesting? Even though I know that this has now been adapted into an HBO limited series, and I know that Mark Ruffalo plays the Birdsey twins in the HBO limited series, I have not been picturing Mark Ruffalo at all.
Me neither.
I've 100% been picturing Mark Ruffalo, so I want to know what everyone else
is
picturing.
No, I've been picturing a Ruffalo type for sure.
I feel like Mark Ruffalo always plays like a little more likable, a little more like morally good. Like I'm picturing like his spotlight character that I have trouble picturing a Ruffalo this sort of low down, like on the rough and tumble.
Yeah,
like,
I think I'm picturing Ruffalo from 13 going on 30 and not the Ruffalo that is in the trailer and the show. Like I'm picturing younger Ruffalo.
Before we go into the rest of the book, can we just all say our favorite Ruffalos? My Ruffalo of preference is from Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
The glasses.
A good Ruffalo.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a solid Ruffalo.
I'm going to say aesthetically, I like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind because I'm a sucker for glasses. But in terms of personality, I'm all Spotlight Ruffalo. I love when he's like, the Pope, even if it goes up to the Pope. I like his little Boston accent.
You know, for some reason, the kids are all right. Ruffalo really popped into my head. Like, it's a really, like, maybe it's just like a stasis Ruffalo, you know? It's like nothing too, he's not too sexy, but he's also not too, he's just like a good guy that's around. I think, I don't really remember the movie.
It's a hot Ruffalo. Hot Ruffalo.
Hot Ruffalo.
Yeah.
What about you,
Jennifer Antienne?
Well, you know, I'm going to say Spotlight Ruffalo, and I actually thought Mark Ruffalo was kind of perfect for this, because I think maybe because of his political involvement, I think of Mark Ruffalo as being a very righteous person, and because of the Hulk, I think of him as also being a person who maybe secretly is angry all the time. So, Dominic is clearly not secretly angry. Dominic is very
so
openly angry at everybody.
So angry.
Yeah.
So angry. Mine's, yeah, I go to 13 going on 30 Mark Ruffalo just because that's the one that pops in my head. And I love a simple rom-com.
Yeah.
Yeah. Gotta love a rom-com, which this is not.
No, this is absolutely not. So to continue on in the very much not a rom-com story, the major conflict that I think that Dominic is dealing with in the first 15 chapters is obviously his brother does this enormously public act of self-mutilation. He's brought to the hospital, but then to a mental institution that's more, I don't know, how do you describe it? As opposed
just a maximum security.
It's maximum security.
Maximum security.
Maximum security,
A more severe place than his usual, like, group, outpatient, sort of centric facility.
Mm-hmm. And I think one of the big things also is that the hatch, I think it was called. Yeah, the hatch in the new facility versus Settle, the old facility, has more surveillance, which for a paranoid schizophrenic is just like possibly
really
the worst possible thing that you could do.
Yeah. I mean, I understand both
sides. I understand why.
Like, yeah.
Right.
And he's very comfortable at Settle, and like he like works the coffee, or he gets the coffee and works the newsstand, and it's like his home. And so that's very stressful.
He's very settled. Yeah. One might say.
Oh,
yeah. And Dominic really tries to fight to get him back to Settle, where his brother seemed to be doing better until he cut his hand off. But for political reasons, because it's such a high profile case, the powers that be kind of need to throw the book at it a mm-hmm. little bit. Like we were saying before, like mm-hmm. it was this really terrifying scene where a man threw his severed hand across a library. And just for public appearances, you need to be like, well, we're putting him in maximum security, mm-hmm. getting evaluated. And it makes the system feel very futile and scary.
It was really interesting in that one chapter where he does meet with that social worker. And she essentially tells him that like this sort of move is like a PR move. Mm-hmm. From the cops, that like, because there was an incident where someone who had no history of violence snapped, as they said, yeah. and attacked someone and killed someone. So like, they're doing this to Thomas as a show of, you know, conservative action.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. What I was going to say is, I think that it's really interesting that Dominic keeps bringing up, like, people keep saying that he's violent, but he only mm-hmm. hurt himself.
Yeah.
And he's not a danger to anyone else. He's his own worst enemy, and he's only dangerous to himself.
Mm-hmm. But I think what's important and what made me feel for some of the workers there was the fact that she immediately replies, well, he counts.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you're violent to yourself, that's still a violent act.
Violence to yourself
counts.
Or others.
You matter. Yeah. Yeah.
I think that it's interesting. I didn't want to dive into this so soon, but I feel like the natural progression is Dominic as a narrator is not a fundamentally great person across the board.
Yeah.
He's incredibly sexist and homophobic in his attitude.
And racist.
And racist.
Oh my God.
Oh yeah.
Racist, homophobic. Yeah. And I mean, there's some like 90s language in here where you're like, okay, I guess people said that, but Jesus Christ.
Some of it is not just the 90s, no. though, because I remember a good chunk of the 90s and I'm like, oh. There is a balance between like 90s language and then things that were just plain racist even in the 90s.
I feel like the homophobia to me feels a little more 90s.
Yeah.
It does, but it doesn't, because his girlfriend Joy also calls him
off. Yeah.
Yeah.
She says she's homophobic. Yeah. And she's correct.
She's correct. 100%.
But I do think it was more mainstream for men to be called homophobic and it be okay that they were homophobic. It's like, oh, that guy, he's just a homophobe. Like, it was like, silly Dominic.
You scamp.
I feel like when you hear about Joy's gay friend, Ted, who makes Duchess potatoes and lives in like a beautiful condo and plans to become a caterer, I just wanted to disappear to their world. I just thought maybe the book could like swerve over.
His husband's architect,
very supportive.
Right?
Yeah.
Right? And they take like mixology classes together. Yeah. I'm so into it.
What a fun thing to do. I would have been okay if we just swerved for like a romantic comedy where Ted helps Joy find love and heal.
You know, Ted is like you leave him, honey. Leave him. You know, just like it's like every day. Like, when are you leaving him?
Yeah, get out.
It's not
get out.
He
like,
care about
is it
you.
Next week? We gotta have a plan.
She is a hot 23-year-old fitness instructor who can
Joy has options. Yeah.
As I'm reading that the whole time, I'm like, Joy, why are you with him?
Well, yeah. I feel like Joy
she's a spending
is
problem
with him because she has low self-esteem she has problems because of the fact that she was sexually abused when she was 13 years old.
Which he is so dismissive.
Which Dominic completely dismisses. That he's like, well, it was consensual, but I guess you'd call it statutory, where it's like, no, an uncle,
because she was
an
13.
Uncle molesting a 13-year-old girl is in universe consensual.
But Dana,
consensual when you're 13.
He wrote,
there just isn't.
But she wrote him letters, so obviously,
of course,
was
she ate his fingernails.
Love. Oh God,
I know he's like more disturbed by her. Like her actions and like her eating the fingernails, then like the like never condemns the uncle's actions at all in telling us this entire story. It's really wild.
Yeah.
But what I wanted to point out is that even though our narrator, Dominic, is sexist, racist, homophobic, yes. I do really value kind of that Wally Lamb is building this world around him where it's like, oh, well, I don't think Wally Lamb is not those things. Like, we're even though we're through Dominic's perspective, I think we're getting like really interesting women and people of color and these stories that Dominic can't see, but we as the reader can see. Like the story of the Drinkwaters and Dr. Patel, who's the dopest character in the whole book. Yeah.
The Drinkwaters. Yeah, that was Lord.
So God.
Do we, who
wants? That almost took me out though. Like just given everything that's happening in the world right now, the fact that Dominic went and accused a little black girl, she's mixed, but you know, she for all intents and purposes reads as black, accused a little black girl of theft, made her cry in front of the principal. No one believed her. Everyone believed him.
He was a hero.
Not in his defense, but just to say the reason they believed him and not her was partly because she did have a record for stealing food.
But she was hungry.
We later find out because she was hungry, which nobody addresses. So he makes her cry, and then the next day she gets kidnapped and murdered.
And then he writes an essay.
And then he writes a speech.
And then he writes a speech and gets chosen to read it out loud at the like memorial service at the school. It is just such a sick little twisted thing that he does in that chapter.
Yep.
I had to put the book down.
I'm sorry. The thing afterwards where he sees Ralph get upset in class because the teacher has said that they just got rid of all the Indians. They're all gone.
They disappeared.
And Ralph is part Indian. Yeah, they disappeared. And then he realizes like, maybe racism is kind of wrong. And it just feels like such a feeble, inadequate response to everything he's done.
I found
that
the most
with that exact family.
One of the most chilling moments of Dominic recounting the Penny is, I think her name is Penny Ann, the sister who gets murdered.
Penny Ann, yeah.
Is that he's like, I told the teacher that she was bragging about stealing Oreos. And I knew that they would believe me.
Yes.
That is exactly the sort of like systemic racism that still exists. We're like that. I mean, not to bring up current events, but that woman calling the police and knowing how she can twist a story to her benefit. It's like, and Dominic knew that they would believe him.
And beyond that, he was like getting angry that like, he's like, they better believe me. Like he was like, I better win this. Even though he was like getting indignant that she was fighting for her truth, which was the truth.
He forgot that he lied. Yeah. That's the craziest part.
He forgot
that the whole thing was something that he invented.
Yes.
And the whole reason he did it was because she lied about saying that her mom was going to get her a Shetland pony for her birthday. Yeah. And it's like, let her lie. We all lied when we were in third grade.
My best friend in elementary school said that her house used to belong to giants and they had to renovate it to make it person sized.
That's an awesome
lie. That's hilarious.
Lie.
I wish that was true and good. It's awesome.
That is a very good lie.
My little niece is a huge liar. Just constant lies flying out of her mouth. It's
kids
beautiful.
Love lying.
But it's just fun.
Yeah. I told kids in kindergarten that I was the author of Benicula.
That's hilarious.
You know what you could have been, Jennifer.
And, thank you. Yeah. I could not fully read at that point, so it would have been like an incredible achievement. But
yeah. That's so funny.
You're listening to Popcorn Book Club from iHeartRadio, and we'll be back right after the break.
Hi, I'm Michael Rappaport.
And I'm Kibi Rappaport.
And together we're hosting Rappaport's Reality Podcast.
We have a passion for reality TV, and we're inviting you into our living room.
We're talking tea, we're dissecting the drama, and we're giving praise to the single greatest form of entertainment on television today. That is right. Reality TV is the greatest form of entertainment on television today.
Here are some examples of what you'll hear from us on Rappaport's Reality Podcast.
This is where we discuss all things reality TV, all things popular culture.
And a little bit of Rappaport's reality, the reality of us.
We're figuring out. And if we had been recording these last 4 or 5 days, It would have been, podcast would have taken a left turn.
Listen to Rappaport's Reality with me, Kibi Rappaport.
And me, Michael Rappaport, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.
Hey, I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go, right? There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. On NPR's new podcast, Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's part existential deep dive and part game show. I ask actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to ask some of life's biggest questions. Listen to NPR's Wildcard on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey guys, I'm home.
Everyone knows that it's Dad's job to be a bit of a joker.
Sorry I'm late, everyone. There was an accident at the factory. Monty fell into the upholstery machine. Don't worry, though. He's fully recovered.
Good one, Dad.
Did you get the pizza for dinner?
So he likes to keep everyone happy with some dad jokes.
Yep, right here. I had a coupon, and it saved me a lot of dough.
Well, the truth is, Dad is just a fun guy.
Hey, I'm not a mushroom.
Please stop. Where does he get these stupid jokes from?
He listens to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast.
Oh, great. More dad jokes for me.
We've delivered over 15,000 jokes to over 3 million listeners, and man, the postage fees are killing us. Listen to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast every day on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So we're back with Popcorn Book Club from iHeartRadio.
So we sort of do get this main narrative about Dominic and Thomas and the challenges of, you know, having an identical twin who's sort of having this descent into further paranoid schizophrenia peppered in with these anecdotes. And I want to focus on a different anecdote that broke my heart. I would say like the second saddest I've been in this book, although it's hard to say.
Yeah, it's hard to rank.
The New York City trip.
Oh, God, I forgot about that.
I know.
The field trip.
So what happens in this one, just to refresh your memory, is the boys' school is going on a field trip to New York City to like see a show at Radio City Music Hall and see the mm-hmm. Statue of Liberty from Connecticut where they live. And we sort of see that this is where Dominic was trying to distance himself from Thomas, which I think all kids, if you have like a lame brother or lame sibling, like you sort of do that at some point. And so he sort of is trying to align himself with the cool kid, and he's not sitting with Thomas on the bus. And then Thomas accidentally locks himself in the bathroom on the bus. And just the way it's described is so vivid and so humiliating, both for Thomas and also I really did feel for Dominic in this awful way where you know that like he's not being a good person, but also who among us hasn't been like humiliated like that?
And I can just like that feeling of just thinking about being in Thomas's shoes and like having everyone on the bus shout at you.
Yeah.
Just like the kids, the students, the driver, the teacher, and just like everyone telling you how to fix something that you just can't.
And
in the moment of anxiety, you can't figure it out.
Ugh. Yeah. And you're in this small little room that smells like literal shit. And it's just like, I feel like I've been that kid several times where just like you don't. And it's just like a simple thing that if you just it's like the left, right. It was like tell him to make it go right. And then it was just he just mixed those up and it was just so devastating.
It's so awful in precisely the way that children actually are awful.
Yes.
I think as adults, I see like kids in third grade now and I think, oh, they're adorable.
Monsters.
Like, what are they reading? It's so cute. And then you remember that when you were that age, they were life size and they were monsters. They have no patience with anything. They can say vividly cruel things without anyone calling them out or any personal feelings of guilt. And that's everything that's happening to Thomas.
Yeah. And also what stuck out for me in that scene, there were two things. There were three things. First is that Dominic was ultimately concerned with whether or not this cool rich kid would still be his friend afterward. And I think that being accepted in that way was something that was very important to him, and he could see it literally just slipping away as his brother became this embarrassment. And I think that that's part of the tough thing about him looking exactly like his brother. And either, like, we all want to distance ourselves from people at times. And it's like, you can't, because they're just a living mirror image of you. And then the second thing that really stuck out to me was that the teacher just was like, oh man, this kid is having a real rough time. Dominic, why don't you stay with him? And it's sort of the beginning of this lifelong thing where Thomas is Dominic's responsibility, even when there are other people who should be more responsible.
That should probably be more responsible.
And like, even as an adult, adultier adults that should be more responsible. I mean, like Ray takes no responsibility as a parental figure as he gets older. And then the other thing was that that scene where they're at the Statue of Liberty and Thomas isn't feeling great. And so Dominic has to stay with him and doesn't get to go inside the Statue of Liberty is the first time that he swears out loud. It's the first time he says the F word out loud when he tells Thomas to shut the fuck up. And I think that that sort of is the beginning of lifelong anger.
You really see why he's such an angry person, because he decides to be a martyr, which is interesting because Thomas is literally trying to be a martyr. But I feel like with Dominic, he takes care of his brother, but he uses it as a reason to be angry with the world. And you're right, that started right there. I also found it so interesting how he spent that money, the $37 or whatever that he saved just on nothing, just to make, which is so relatable when you're upset. You're just like, I'm just going to spend a bunch of money and all the money that I have, and maybe that will make me feel something. And it never does, you know?
The religion is so interesting because obviously them being identical twins, they are sort of that mirror image where Thomas falls into being, I think, past incredibly religious, thinking he's literally like a prophet of God in some of his, delusions. Dominic, after going through numerous tragedies and losses, accepts that there is no God. And so he becomes incredibly nihilistic, but as you said, still thinks of himself as a martyr. And it goes back to Cain and Abel, the story of the biblical brothers. He goes, I'm not my brother's keeper. And so it's I'm not a biblical scholar, but it's this, that is such a fundamental tie of what is your responsibility to your literal brother and to mankind? And they've taken different approaches towards, religion and God. And I think it also goes in chapter 15, when he's talking with Dr. Patel, he kind of admits how much it has hurt him that Thomas no longer seems to look out for him, that Thomas in his schizophrenia becomes really, narcissistic and self-looking. And so I think that's sort of an interesting thing where Dominic feels like he always has to watch out for his brother.
I love Dr. Patel. I love that her counter to that is, well, aren't we all a little narcissistic? And she gives that particular anecdote about how she was running late to a meeting and the guy in front of her was going really slowly. And she's like, why is he making me late for my meeting? When it's maybe he is not a confident driver. And he's like, why is this person trying to get me to speed behind him? And so we're all sort of wrapped up. And I definitely default to that in our own narrative where we're the star of our own story. Hopefully a romantic comedy for me first.
And not a CIA thriller for Thomas.
The thing about Dominic too is that he is such this martyr. He's this belabored martyr, but he's such an unlikable character in so many ways and is very angry. But there are so many moments that I feel very tender to him. Even though he's so unlikable, just him talking about how he would go visit his brother every single Sunday. And that scene where Joy's like, can you just not do it for one weekend? And he's like, no, my brother is expecting me. It's almost like he needs it as well in knowing that his brother is doing okay. In those moments, I'm like, oh, Dominic, you're so tender and loving and also a total asshole and using it in this martyr-y way.
I kind of feel like anyone in this book can be slightly redeemed just by being nice to Dominic. I felt the same way to a much lesser extent about
the ending
Leo.
Of that chapter.
Just
seems like a nightmare of a person, just cheats on his wife relentlessly, like was addicted to cocaine.
Yeah, that was very casually mentioned, the cocaine addiction.
Yeah, just seems like kind of a mess. But then he says, you know, if you want to put me on the visitors list, yeah, I'll go down and I'll see Thomas. And I thought, oh, that's really kind to do. Yeah, that's that's really nice.
We also get kindness from Dessa, his Dominic's ex-wife.
Oh, yeah, well, she's great.
I don't think Dessa's done a single thing wrong. No. Dessa is the only character
Dessa's,
in this
Dessa's
book.
She's
just,
person.
Like, perfect.
She was, like, Dessa's the best story. Part of Dominic. You know, it felt like that was his goodness was in Dessa. And now that he's separated from that, it's like part of his goodness is gone, you know?
Yeah.
I kind of wondered if we'd feel entirely different about this character if we had met him at the point when he and Dessa were expecting a child.
He was a teacher.
And he was doing the pool in his classroom about what the weight was going to be, and everybody was so excited.
I don't know if I'm ready to talk about Angela and that whole story, but the vasectomy thing, oh my, was like one of the worst things I've ever heard someone do in a marriage. But...
How dare
I'm
truly?
I mean,
just
I feel like I feel so responsible for Dessa. Like she's a real person. I'm like, thank God she left. Like, good
she deserves
her.
That artist and that little farm.
Good for you, Dessa.
Their little mailbox.
It sounds like the Potter guy is doing really well.
Yeah.
And that's
I'm glad
nice.
She went to Greece
cool
by
job.
Herself. Like, thank goodness she felt free for the first time. And I really related to her. I feel like I've been in one very bad toxic relationship and earlier on in my life. And it was like, I spent a week away from him. And it was like, when she described how she felt, it was like, it's like, it is this when you're in a with a toxic person and you like separate and you feel like you have your whole self back. Like, I was just like, yeah, Dessa, leave him. Now we just got to work on Joy leaving him.
Well, Joy needs to leave. Yeah. Joy is
fingers
her own
crossed.
Messed up. But I feel like they don't need to be together.
No, he doesn't even seem to like her.
No.
He doesn't. He's still
Why
in love
is she with
Dessa.
Him? He's not nice to her. Yeah. It's I wish Joy would leave.
And there's weird details where you're like, you can sort of read between the lines and be like, oh, Joy's kind of trying. Like at the very end of chapter 15, it's this throwaway detail that she's doing his laundry and like catches a note and is like, oh, did you want this? So it's like, when you think about it, like this woman who he's not nice to at all and is incredibly dismissive of and sexist to in his own internal monologue, he's like, doing his laundry and cleaning his
checking
house. Like,
pockets.
I literally didn't think about that.
I think men like Dominic just take that so much for granted that like the laundry fairy might as well have done it.
Dominic doesn't even acknowledge it. He doesn't see that Joy serves any purpose in his life. Just
I imagine his mother was also kind of forced into the same role.
I was going to say, I bet he had a mom who pretty much catered to everything. I mean, we know his mom as a character in the book, so I can pretty much infer that she wasn't like, okay, you're old enough now, I'm going to teach you how to do your laundry.
I mean, everything that we learn about his mom is also so devastating. It's heartbreaking. It's tragic. Like, we learn that, you know, that she is in this abusive relationship with Ray emotionally and sometimes physically.
Definitely.
And we learn that she dies of breast cancer. And then I was like, this is just going to keep getting sadder, isn't it? We also learn, she has a cleft lip.
A cleft lip hides with her fist all the time.
It's so heartbreaking.
She's always hiding it.
I remember, this is not the same situation at all, but I used to have like a very gummy smile because my jaw was misaligned. So I was probably like, I had more gum than tooth and so for like a good few years when I smiled, I always covered my mouth when I smiled or laughed in person.
Yeah.
And my mom would always say like how much that broke her heart. And when I had to go through like this whole surgery and like getting jaw surgery, it was like a whole thing. But it was like, it was such a weird and visceral thing that I've never really talked about, like how nice it is to like want to smile and not cover your mouth.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like on that episode of Queer Eye. Did you with the sisters that like?
Yes.
And she had messed up teeth, and she would always cover her mouth, and then at the end they fix her teeth, and then she's smiling with it. That made me cry.
That's really
yeah.
Nice.
It was very nice.
Does Dominic's mother ever get to be happy? Is it just that one day where they get to meet who is Mrs. Eisenhower?
Eisenhower. That was the one time.
I think she was almost happy when they went out to the movies for the back to school day.
Yeah.
And then she got that painting and she was like, I'm going to get this painting of Jesus because it makes me happy. But then was like sexually harassed on the bus.
Yeah. Immediately.
I think that image of the quote unquote crazy man on the bus who sexually harasses Ma, I think really haunts Dominic because obviously he has the same genetics as Thomas. And I think this idea of crazy is very nebulous, you know, to his understanding. And I think he has this deep fear of becoming the crazy man on the bus.
He marked that. It was like this face that haunts my dreams. Cause I thought it was going to be, I mean, obviously it was a terrifying scene, but I thought something worse was going to happen. Like, you know, they would be go to the hospital or something because of the way he marks it, you know, of how this face will forever haunt him. And I also just thinking about like toxic relationships and abusive relationships when she goes home and is crying and can't stop crying and then makes them promise not to tell Ray. It's like that, not to tell Ray that something that was not your fault, a very bad thing, scary thing that happened that was not your fault. It's such a clear sign of abuse of like he would have yelled at her about that. That would have turned into a fight. And it was just very heartbreaking.
Yeah. The other scene about Ma that was like so heartbreaking was when she gets them that gift, the typewriter, and like wants them to go to college. But Ray's like, they don't have enough. We as a family don't have enough. And so she wants to try and work. And just thinking about her on that first day of work with her hands shaking. And it took me back to my mom because my mom stayed at home. And then when all of us had grown up, she like started working again for the first time in like 20 years. And it never hit me like how nerve-wracking that must be to have been out of the workforce for so long and then going out into it just like the thought of the hands shaking and her going out to work and then not even getting to do it. It was just so, it was heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think it's also like a tiny little bit of a triumphant moment for me too, that Ray tells her that she will never be able to get a job. Right. Like, what does she even know how to do? She goes down to a hotel and she applies and she gets hired immediately.
Yeah.
Calls
his bluff.
Yeah. And I understand that she did not want to work and that should be a choice for people. But I desperately wish she had taken that job because I think it might have given her a support system outside of a home. It might have let her see that there were people who valued her labor and
I think Ma is a incredibly heartbreaking character, but Ray is also this major figure that looms over Dominic. The detail that stuck with me is this idea that Ray kind of preferred Dominic. And Dominic goes into this with Dr. Battelle, but this weird feeling of like both guilt and pride that Ray was sort of like, you know, because Dominic was more of like an athlete, more popular, that he really attacked Ma and Thomas and Dominic sort of got away. I don't know. What did you guys make of that?
I just want to say something about the work scene because that was when like the racism really jumped out at me because that scene, I don't know if y'all remember, but has the N-word in it. Mm-hmm. And that's what really forces Ray's hand in this college situation. And he's like, fine, I will pay for college because I don't want my wife to have to do nigger work. And just for everybody listening, a reminder, I am Black. so you can't see me, but I am. But that I had to put the book down after that because I was like, oh God, it's not even about like, I want you to stay home because of being a homemaker is a full-time job and you're not going to be able to do that well. And we've arranged this house so that it works this way. Or I want you to be home for the kids.
Deep-seated
racism.
Yeah.
Yep.
And this deep-seated like honor thing, like you are my property and I don't want anyone to see my property engaged in something that I believe to be beneath them.
Yeah.
And that just like made my skin crawl. And Ray, from then on, I was just like, I don't care what he does. He's trash.
Ray is the least redeemable character in this book.
Yes.
Because he both physically and psychologically abuses Thomas, Dominic, Ma. I mean, he physically abuses Thomas in the book.
Well, there's a moment that was, I also feel like, kind of glossed over, where Dominic talks about when they were younger, he has them kneeling on rice. Yes.
Oh, my God. That was terrifying. Because you don't even, like, when they said it, I was like, what is, what? And then when he explained, and he didn't even understand until it was happening, the pain of it. And then, like, the taping his
That was his hands. The taping.
Hands, so he couldn't eat.
It was so he had to eat like a dog, they said.
It was such, like, this sounds like I'm glorifying it, but, like, creative abuse. Like, abuse of a kind of person that has such a sick mind that they are, like, I don't just want to hit this person. I want to find ways to torture them. It's all it's all means of torture. It was awful.
That was the note I made, that scene that Ray, like, duct tapes Thomas's hands so he can't, I guess, chew on them, whatever he was doing wrong, which children, especially anxious children, do.
Yeah.
And so the scene that they describe then is Thomas having to eat his dinner just with his, like, face, like a dog in a bowl.
Yeah.
And also then I wrote in the margin, like, and then he cuts off his own hand. Like, there has to be some sort of metaphorical parallel to that idea of, like, I don't know. I mean, this is, because this is fiction, I could be reading too much into it. But also there's this idea, like, I think I'm not an expert on psychology or mental illness, but, like, I can't imagine a childhood of traumatic abuse helps healthy development if you're already have those programs inside your brain.
Predisposed to
chemical imbalances.
Chemical things, yeah.
Oh, well, it just broke my heart.
Yeah.
One of the most terrifying moment in this for me is when Ray's solution is like, maybe I should have been harder on him. Like, your mother was always protecting him, so maybe if I just beaten him a little more, it would have been better, which I think we can all agree would not have helped.
No.
And
even if
their childhood already seems very traumatic.
Yeah. Even if that's how paranoid schizophrenia started, was because of behaviors in childhood, no. Like, why would you think that? Because with the rice thing, what stuck out to me about that rice torture was that if you didn't cry, you got to get up. But if you reacted in any way to being tortured, you got tortured longer.
And then with the tragedy is Dominic, his inability to show grief and express himself is partly what leads to the end of his marriage. To get into it a tiny bit, he and his wife, Dessa, lose a child at 3 weeks, incredibly tragically. And Dessa wants him to open up, wants him to be able to express their shared grief. And he bottles it up until he literally just bursts out into tears while teaching a class.
Yeah.
And then he leaves and never comes back.
It gave me so much hope towards the end when Dr. Patel told him that he can't keep being like a Tupperware container with the lid.
I love that she could not remember the word
like
Tupperware.
The things you sell at your home. Your friends come over and sell those things to you.
The parties. The containers with the parties.
But it broke my heart with Dessa, where you could so tell that Dessa needed to share that grief with her partner. And needed him to open up and be there with him and express that. And he could not.
The most heartbreaking moment for me in that maybe was when he hears her crying in the baby's room. And he's like, just lets her cry, like doesn't go comfort her. And he's like.
And has the thought that like only a psychotic person wouldn't go help her. I'm not going to help her, though.
Yeah. And then he thinks back to that moment, like, if I had gone and comforted her, would we still be together? I'm like, maybe.
Maybe.
Like, maybe. Because it could have been like, you might have cried and then you could have talked to each other instead of getting a vasectomy while she's in Greece, a trip that she asked you to come on.
Yeah. I think she's making.
And then you think she'll be happy about it.
I mean.
Without telling her. Yeah. I was like, Dessa was going, doing this really big thing, like, let's go to Greece, let's, like, reconnect, let's be with each other. And then when she comes back, they have this really cathartic moment, and she cries, and you're like, maybe they're going to get through this. And then he's like, I got a vasectomy without telling you.
Well, yeah, he, and then well, she molly wallops his ass.
He's like, and I don't believe in God, and I got a vasectomy.
Yeah. Like, and what I thought was so beautiful in that chapter with Dessa was, like, she had done the work of dealing with this loss and grieving, that she it started to show that she was on the other side of it. Like, not that she was finished grieving, but that her saying that, like, now the memory of this baby is, like, not a tragedy, but it's like she's so grateful. And it really showed, like, that kind of progress that people go through with grief. And she got on the other side of it, but he's just still so stuck in the Tupperware. Of anger, the Tupperware filled with rage, that he did this horrible thing.
Well, because Melissa, if you cry, you get more time kneeling in the right.
Yeah,
true. There is something to him being like that, like the martyr, like taking that position of being the martyr in this situation, where he does describe, like at the very first several weeks, months of after losing their daughter, that he is kind of holding things together, is like letting Dessa, you know, be with her mother and sister and crying and grieving. And he's, you know, doing things around the house, getting groceries together, spending time with his father-in-law. And in some ways is sharing with us that he was an emotional rock, even though it was not the healthiest of things that he was doing, but that sort of like taking that position of being in the martyr, he's doing it all over again, like taking on the emotional burden of like taking care instead of opening up.
It is interesting because, it's like he goes to the funeral home and it's like he does all the things that are taught in sort of like 50s traditional masculine ways in which you handle tragedies. It's like, I'm going to be the tough one that the girl can collapse on, and I'm going to be like a tree trunk, you know, but he can't do the other part.
No.
And it is important to remember that he was raised in the 1950s.
Yes.
Because when the book starts, he's like 40, I think.
Yeah.
This is Popcorn Book Club. We'll be right back after this quick break.
Hi, I'm Michael Rappaport.
And I'm Kibi Rappaport.
And together we're hosting Rappaport's Reality Podcast.
We have a passion for reality TV, and we're inviting you into our living room.
We're talking tea, we're dissecting the drama, and we're giving praise to the single greatest form of entertainment on television today. That is right. Reality TV is the greatest form of entertainment on television today.
Here are some examples of what you'll hear from us on Rappaport's Reality Podcast.
This is where we discuss all things reality TV, all things popular culture.
And a little bit of Rappaport's reality, the reality of us.
We're figuring out. And if we had been recording these last 4 or 5 days, it would have been,
the
podcast would have taken a left turn.
Listen to Rappaport's Reality with me, Kibi Rappaport.
And me, Michael Rappaport, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.
Hey, I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go, right? There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. On NPR's new podcast, Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's part existential deep dive and part game show. I ask actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to ask some of life's biggest questions. Listen to NPR's Wildcard on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey guys, I'm home.
Everyone knows that it's Dad's job to be a bit of a joker.
Sorry I'm late, everyone. There was an accident at the factory. Monty fell into the upholstery machine. Don't worry, though. He's fully recovered.
Good one, Dad.
Did you get the pizza for dinner?
So he likes to keep everyone happy with some dad jokes.
Yep, right here. I had a coupon, and it saved me a lot of dough.
Well, the truth is, Dad is just a fun guy.
Hey, I'm not a mushroom.
Please stop. Where does he get these stupid jokes from?
He listens to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast.
Oh, great. More dad jokes for me.
We've delivered over 15,000 jokes to over 3 million listeners, and man, the postage fees are killing us. Listen to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast every day on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, we're back with Popcorn Book Club.
I want to take a brief detour. There is one story we get early on that seems to be kind of a departure because it's not about tragedy, really, and it's not about Thomas, but it's a story about Ma having a handwritten memoir written by her father.
Yeah.
and again, it feels like a weird departure. Like, so the story is Ma has a handwritten memoir by her immigrant father who came from Italy and built himself up. And we get this subplot of he tried to hire a stenographer and it didn't work. So then he's like, I'm just doing it myself. and we get, he's Dominic's namesake, Domenico. But basically Ma leaves it to Dominic and is like, here's, you know, your grandfather's memoir and story, but it's all in peasant Italian.
And so, peasant Sicilian,
my apologies. And he brings it to a local university to get a grad student to translate it for him. And we get this story about a woman named Nidra. Does someone want to pick it up from Nidra. There?
I mean, with Nidra, I only want to say that he describes her. The thing that stuck out to me, and only maybe because I'm like, my partner is a professor, so I'm like, this sticks out to me so much. But he walks in and is like, she looked about 40, or who knows? You can't tell with women who pull their hair back tight up into a bun and wear glasses around their neck. And I was like, oh, that's so rude.
I have both of these things going on right now. I could be 40, I could be 20. You just don't know.
You just don't know.
I assumed you were 8 years old, Melissa. I cannot tell. I don't know.
Can't tell.
Well, I can take it from here a little bit, but he asks this woman to translate this book for her, and she's very, which I love, she's like unemotionally attached to the whole project, doesn't see why this is like of utmost importance to this man, but is just like, yeah, sure, I'll charge such and such page for such and such. I think it's like $8 a page or five bucks a page. Fair.
It was very expensive.
Is it really?
That's a lot of money.
Well, yeah. Whatever rate he is, he agrees
especially to it. Especially
in 1990. Yeah. Right. Oh my gosh. Yeah. Right. I'm thinking about
it. Or earlier. I guess because the big event happened in 1990. So this could be like 85 maybe.
Yeah. Because it was like
$8
what,
a page.
So she's charging high quality premium prices.
Find someone who could do that.
Yeah. He should have asked around.
Although, you know what? What she's saying is she has a very specific skill set where knowing peasant Sicilian is not, probably does not have a lot of income opportunities. And so she's like, here's an opportunity. I am getting paid.
Yeah. Yeah.
I just think it's important to note that the mom is actively dying during this whole process. And she's like, it does not faze her at all. It's like, okay, well, it's going to take a long time. And I don't care that your mother has months to live.
He wanted to have it translated so that he could give it to his mom before she died.
To his mother as a gift. Yeah. I just kept thinking, social media is very bad on a lot of levels. But the one thing that I thought would be great is if you were doing this today, you would just put a post up on Facebook saying like, hey, does anybody speak Sicilian? I need a book in like 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Can you like give me a rough translation? People would have done it for like $150. Yeah.
Isn't it in that first meeting too, as she's flipping through the book and seeing that it's like put together haphazardly, some of it's typed, some of it's in peasant Sicilian, some of it is in Italian. And she's like, man, is your grandfather a schizo? She makes a quick little reference like, whoa, was he a schizo? And Dominic is like, fills with rage. Yeah. And I think turns to leave. And then she's like, fine, I'll do it. And I think that's maybe the first little glimpse that we get about Papa and like having this offhanded comment from this woman. And then, I mean, the big arc of it is that she ends up coming over to his house one night, getting super drunk during a snowstorm, tries to like hook up with him. He doesn't want it. And then she runs away accusing him of sexual assault, takes the memoir and all the pages, and then disappears.
completely bounces.
Completely bounces. From her job.
There's a really important detail that you forgot. She stole the blanket off of his bed.
Oh, really?
Also. Wait, she didn't take it home with her. She didn't take it home with her. But when he was getting the pizza or something, like, he stepped out of the room for a moment and she had gone up into his bedroom and taken the comforter off of his bed and wrapped herself in it. And I was just like, she has no boundaries.
Yeah.
No boundaries.
She so aggressive, just like eventually like getting her own beers and just like being like, well, what are we doing for dinner? Just
oh yeah, he hasn't given her his address.
She took it off the
shows up at
she
his
took
house.
It off the check that he gave her. Like my and what
she is the most aggressive person in this book.
Yeah.
I love Nedra Frank. She's so weird.
She's played by Juliette Lewis, too, which I feel
that's very good.
That makes sense to me.
Yeah.
That
makes me want to watch the show. I haven't watched it yet. But that detail, I'm like, I want to see that.
That's perfect casting.
Yes, agreed.
I haven't watched any of it yet, and I didn't look at any casting either.
Can I also say there's the one very funny detail about Nedra, and maybe it's like funny just because the rest of this book is so pitch black, but the fact that she's like, when he like checks in with her, she's like, you shouldn't give this book to your mom. You haven't read this, but this sucks. She's like, this book straight up sucks.
And your grandfather's a misogynist and an
like a nightmare. Yeah, it's funny because that whole section, it felt like comedy, even though it's so dark, but it just everything else is so bleakly sad that somehow like a woman being aggressive while trying to fulfill his mom's dying wish and going crazy and losing the one thing that was gifted to him is like, what a farce.
No, it is really farcical, but it also made me really sad.
It was
because
very
at some
sad.
Point he visits his grandfather's grave, and on his grandfather's grave is written, "The greatest griefs are silent." And clearly this was a man who like tried to air those griefs, and he tried to put them someplace, and he tried to write about them, and now they're just gone, and nobody will ever know about them.
I feel like she's got to come back.
Yeah, she's going to come back, for sure.
I feel like there will be a return
because
of Nedra.
Because it does feel like, and this might seem obvious, but that it is such a mirror of, like, he is writing this memoir, even though it's fiction, like, it is this memoir of his life, and it does keep going back to his childhood and teenage years and building out the story of him and his brother, and then he is, like, trying to craft this, like, bring back this memoir of his grandfather. And it does feel like obvious parallels between the two of like this man. It's all from his perspective, you know, and it does feel and it kind of bounces around. And so it feels like it's paralleling those.
To build, I just have a quick question. Because I don't know if it's just I got an old copy, but my pages are like purposefully old and like oniony, like the book, the grandfather's like manuscript is described. When I first got it, my girlfriend was like, okay, that book is fucked up. Don't bring it into the bedroom.
cursed.
Like it's had like damaged or like filthy, like we didn't know. But then I looked at it, I was like, wait a minute, no, this is intentional.
That's so good. I think the idea that the best Greeks are silent, like that is, I feel like the struggle to be able to own your story is like, this is toxic masculinity, the musical.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, and it's just clearly continuing the cycle with another Italian-American man named Dominic, who is trying to share his grief in some way that he can at least put it someplace. I hope we get to read some of his grandfather's memoir. I really want to know why he and grandma aren't buried together.
Ooh.
Like something bad happened
there. I
want
to know more about Ma's past. I want to know who their father is. I want to know if it's
I want to know who their father is. And you know what? In normal people, we never found out who Connell's father was. And I want to know who Dominic and Thomas's father is. I want to know who people's fathers are now.
Maybe that's
my requirement for our next book.
We have to know who their father is. Every book we read, we never know who the father is.
It's the Mary Povich book club.
That's the theme of this podcast now. It's no longer about things getting turned into TV movies. The father thing, one thing that stood out to me when he was talking about Ray, there was the end of one chapter was like, our father could be anyone. It could be Alessandro. It could be this person. It could be that person. It could be anyone in the world, but it's definitely not Ray. And it's just so interesting, like, how, I mean, Ray is a terrible man, but just how he, like, will never accept that Ray is his father, you know?
Yeah, he constantly is reminding people that Ray is his stepfather. Although... Although they have Ray's last name, which I think is notable. And
yeah.
It's sort of an interesting thing that Dominic never rebelled against, never changed. He sort of tacitly accepts that Ray is the father figure in his life while still vehemently knowing in his heart that he is just his stepfather.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, Ray lives in his childhood house now.
And he's the only person that lives there.
His grandfather built.
And they once had their mom's last name because early on they mentioned that when they were born, and it was like a news story because they were born on the New Year's, that they had their mom's last name. But then when she married Ray, they all sort of took that heteronormative 1950s little family ideal.
Which is such an interesting detail. Good job, Wally. The twins twins being on either side of the year. I was like, okay. Mm-hmm. Nice time, Wally.
Yeah. Good to see you, Wally.
And like the first half and second half of the century, too.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think it's also an indication of how separate they are as twins, even though they came from the same egg and everything.
Yeah.
They're not even born the same day or the same year. That's how wildly different they are, even though they look
the same. The same half of the century. Wally really, he's going in.
Can we take bets on if we find out or not? Who thinks we will find out?
Who the father?
I don't think we're going to find out. All right. Well, so me, Tien, and Jennifer are on Team Find Out.
Yes,
and Karama and Melissa are on Never Find Out. No, Ma gets a love story. I want Ma to have a lost love. It's going to be a lost tragedy.
Well, it's not going to be good.
It's going to be a bad. It's going to be a tragedy.
Sad, I think
it's going to be bad.
Either way,
it's going to be bad. She's so deeply religious and has these babies out of wedlock and then also never tells anyone. And they say there are two things they never talked about, who their father is and their mom's cleft lip.
Yeah.
And she brings up the lip once, but then never bring up the father. Oh. So I feel like there's something bad there or something sad there that I don't want to get into.
Although the religious element is interesting, that it could sort of be an Immaculate Conception reference.
Or she could have had sex with a priest. That's where I go with
that. Oh, that story where she brought up the cleft lip to Dominic was so sad.
It was so sad.
So sad with the glasses.
Mm-hmm. And he really shut the hell up after that.
And then...
And he was still an asshole about it.
He was still an asshole. And then he puts on the glasses and is amazed by which I remember that because I, wear glasses and contacts. And I remember in high school, I kept on asking this girl in front of me. I was in the back of my math class and I was like, what does that say? And I was like, this math teacher is like, just not focusing the projector. It's so annoying. And then she's like, Melissa, do you want to try on my glasses? And I was like, okay. And I was like, this is how the world looks to people. Like you can see leaves on trees all the time.
So I feel like it really marks
that moment. Amazing. But then he doesn't tell his mom, he doesn't tell his mom that actually this is wonderful,
Right.
Poor Ma, long suffering. She's the real martyr.
Yeah.
I know.
Yeah.
She doesn't even get the clock that she wants.
That's true. She sacrifices her clock for the typewriter.
Yeah.
So what else do people want to see in the next chapters of the book? Paternity.
I want to see Grandfather Domenico's memoir. I'm really curious about what he was up there writing all that time.
Yeah. I'd love to, and I hope that means the return of Nedra.
Yes.
I just want to see a little bit more of messy Nedra doing something crazy, being a real weird fun girl.
Truly a messy legend.
Yes, yeah. True messy it legend. Is.
We stand a messy legend.
Karama, what about you? Did you get a request for where you want Wally to go?
I want to see the paternity, obviously, but also I want to see Thomas okay. Like, I want to see a positive, sustainable future for Thomas.
Yes.
Because I don't think I've talked about this, but one of my worst fears is being institutionalized. Like, all of my worst fears were actually realized in season 2 of American Horror Story. It was like, it was handcrafted to torture me because I'm afraid of being murdered for my skin, and I'm afraid of Nazis, and I'm afraid of being institutionalized, and all of that's in there.
Yeah.
Also aliens. Wow. So, yeah. But I feel like he's in this position where he was in a pretty good spot, and now he's obviously gotten into a worse spot, and I really don't want him to be in Hatch for like years and years and years.
Yeah.
And I think that there's nobody at this point in the book that can take on the responsibility of being his full-time caregiver outside of a facility. And I think that he does benefit from being in a facility where he can get round the clock care, people who are trained in how to properly handle his schizophrenic delusions and everything. But I would like to see him back at Settle, and I would like to see some of the stuff that Dr. Patel talks about in the last chapter, where it's about like getting him into a group home or something where he is able to be his own advocate and do adult things that some of us sort of take for granted, like paying bills and stuff like that. So that's something that I'd like to see. We still have a lot of book to go. I have no idea what's going to happen, but I hope something good happens for Thomas.
Dr. Patel gives me hope. Like, that chapter really gave me a lot of hope for him and for Dominic. Like, it felt like she was really breaking through to Dominic, getting through his rage issues and all of that. And it seems hopeful, like it's this sort of co-therapy thing that she's doing by the setup of that seems interesting. Can I say something very silly? I love genre mystery, sci-fi, like all of that sort of stuff. And that's a lot of what I read. And I have, like, at some point my brain, especially in the Dr. Patel chapter, went to like, what if they're the same person? And if this is just all delusions, that it's like he's on the outside and Dr. Patel is like, yeah, let's talk about your twin. And I'm like, ooh, okay, yeah. And I'm like, no, that's not what this book is. It is not what this book is.
Oh, that would be genius.
It's not it. It's just a sad story. I just wanted it to be more like a Fight Club story as opposed to just like a bleakly sad story.
I know, when I was first reading it, my brain was like, okay, can this get better if they accidentally take Dominic instead of Thomas and Dominic is in Hatch? And then I was like, well, he cut his hand off, so there's no...
Yeah, I was going to say, there's no mistaking them anymore. Yeah.
There's no mistaking them.
No. I did want to just say a quick thing about Dr. Patel, is she was so smart and so slick in that she knows that Dominic is such a martyr that he will do things to help Thomas, that the only way that he would agree to like this therapy that he so desperately needs is that Dr. Patel frames it as like, will you do this for me to help Thomas? And you're like, well, she knows that it's also definitely helping
for him.
Dominic.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, you're so good at this.
Oh, there's something that we have not talked about.
What?
We didn't talk about the fact that they asked Dominic if he wanted to reattach Thomas's hand.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Like, he had to make that choice. He had to say, no, don't reattach his hand. And I think part of it, he said it was because he's just going to cut it off again. Because that's what Thomas said. He was like, I'm just going to cut it off again, dude. But I think also it's a way to distinguish himself finally. Visually.
Oh, I hadn't even thought about that. Yeah. Oh.
Yep. A visceral, real, tangible difference. So it's like, he can't take, you're right. Like, obviously, the, I mean, hopefully in a world they wouldn't like put Dominic in the hatch by accident. But you're right. Now they
definitely can't.
I mean, he could just grow a beard, Dominic, you know, like it would be a little easier. On him,
or start wearing his glasses again, because Thomas doesn't wear glasses.
Yeah. Thomas is Superman and Dominic is Clark Kent.
Yeah.
Clark Kent? Yeah.
He seemed to really resent that comparison. He was like, man, no. Yeah.
I'm Superman. Yeah.
That's so, it's interesting. He ascribes that decision also to this feeling of like Thomas, all the agency has been taken out of his life, where it's like he's making this decision. And so he's going to let Thomas have that decision, which I get. That's like such a mate. Although with someone who would unilaterally vasectomize yourself in a marriage, he seems to be someone who is good at making unilateral decisions.
Yeah. And, you know, it is interesting. Vasectomy is not mutilation, but it is a form of like cutting something off. So they, in order to, in a martyr sort of way. So it does feel like they both have voluntarily done this thing that is very detrimental to their lives, like to their bodies.
Do you think that Dominic thinks it's his fault that Angela died? Like that there's something wrong with his ability to create a healthy baby. And like, for me, I feel like he's scared that he's going to have a kid that has paranoid schizophrenia.
Yeah, I think absolutely. I think he thinks his genes are messed up because of Thomas. I mean, that's the scary thing about having an identical twin is knowing that your genetics are the same, that you have the same like predispositions.
Yeah.
Is a scary, scary thing. And maybe he just thinks that, like, if another baby were to die, he just physically couldn't be stoic through that. Like, he would just explode. The Tupperware would burst. It would, because he has, his only coping mechanism is to tamp it down, and he has no more tamp space.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's a tragedy.
It's interesting how we can all feel so sad for this man, and I don't think any of us would like him if we met him.
I am on his side for a maximum of 3 pages. That's what I've realized as I'm reading. I'm like, oh, yeah, yay. And then he, like, says a slur, and I'm like, oh, no, I just remembered who you are. I just remembered at your core who you are.
And also all of the scenes where he, like, loses his temper, especially in the institution. It's like, or with the cop, and with all of, like, he almost has it, and then he just goes too far, and you're reminded of who he really is, and you're just so mad. It's like, no, you could have convinced him if you just kept your cool and weren't so hateful, but you are, so it's a problem.
He's someone who thinks that the world is against him.
Some of the tenderest moments in the book are when people are able to break through to him, though. It's why I love the scenes with Dr. Patel so much.
Yeah.
That she's able to get him to talk about his childhood. And it feels like this almost superhuman power coming from her with a man who is,
I know,
this confrontational with people who are very often trying to
Same
help
with
them.
The social worker. What was her name? Sheffer?
Lisa. Dr. Sheffer.
Lisa Schaefer.
That was a great scene, too. And I love that
she's
moment.
She's also cool.
She's like I'm not a gal. I am a woman.
Woman.
I didn't like how she kept calling him paisano, which I had to look up because I'm not Italian. And apparently it literally translates to peasant, but is, which is interesting because of the peasant Sicilian. But it literally translates to peasant, but the like, the slang is like, friend, pal, homie.
I thought she's also kind of a weirdo, but also
super weird. There are a lot of interesting women in this. Like, I feel like he's surrounded by all of these women who he clearly hates on a visceral level.
He hates his girlfriend, Joy. What? He really does.
He hates her so much.
I want to see Joy leave.
I know. Oh, that's one thing I want to see.
I'm hoping for.
It is interesting because he is surrounded by all these women, and while... Wally, you described their boobs way too much, but but outside of that, I feel like they are so well-formed and unique perspectives, and the way they interact with him are so different and memorable. And I feel like for a man that kind of hates women, like the central character, it is so interesting to be in these scenes with all these very strong personalities that challenge him in different ways. Yeah, I love with Dr. Patel, like, there's this, that one moment in the beginning where she's like, he's like, what kind of tea do you want? And he's like, whatever. And he's like, whatever. That's the male way of just, you know, throwing things away.
It's very passive
and
aggressive.
She makes him decide. And it's like, and he acquiesces. It's like, oh, wow, Dr. Patel, you are good at this.
Yeah. He's like, oh, I'll take the spiced one.
I think we're all writers, you know, to some degree. And so I wonder to what level, like, I think very often when I'm reading a good book, I don't see the strings. But then sometimes when I was writing notes for this, you sort of see the strings a little bit or what's effective. And like, he says he's surprised, Dominic is, when he agrees to accept the tea. And I was like, that's a very poignant detail that he's willing to sit down and like literally drink tea with someone, because the act of like drinking or consuming food with someone is like a very intimate, vulnerable thing. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, Wally, look at you. This guy.
Yeah, when I was in college, there was a guy who told me, he said that he thought that sex was the most intimate thing you could do for someone. And the second most intimate thing you could do for someone was make them a meal. Which I thought was really interesting, because he was like,
"Was that the first thing he said to you?"
No. And this was not a guy that was like trying to hit on me or anything. But he went to another college nearby that focused on culinary school, and so he worked in one of our eateries as in the kitchen. And I was like friends with the people in the kitchen because I love food. So I was like, "Yeah, I'm gonna make real good friends with all the people who are responsible for the food, so then I can get more food," which worked.
Hell yeah.
And but so we would hang out when he was on his breaks and on shifts and stuff, and it wasn't like a sexy thing, but it was just an interesting perspective. And just in terms of having this tea, I do think it is a very intimate thing that she's doing, making him this tea and the ritual of it all, and mm-hmm. how she gets into her own history with tea. And it leads into us learning a lot about her, because she's Indian. So I think we all kind of had that assumption. It's like, oh, yeah, no, she's been drinking tea. And she's like, no, I never drank tea in India. I didn't get into tea until I was in, you know, school in London.
Yeah. It's also the one time that we get to see maybe the only moment of like pure joy from Dominic, where he's like, it warmed me up and it smelled very good. And I was like, oh, what an uncomplicated emotion of joy that you just had. The first one in all 250 pages.
Well, and along with that, Tan, it's like that's the first time when he starts like asking questions about mm-hmm. her. Like he starts relaxing about his brother for the first time, and just like enjoys a conversation with somebody and engages with her. And he's like, I don't know why, but I liked her. It's like, maybe it's just because she's a nice person. I don't know.
Well, there's also something very maternal about making food for people or making tea for someone. It's something that you can very easily imagine his mother doing, and something that maybe is certainly his mother, if she was, I'm pretty sure Ray made sure that his mother had all the meals ready on time. Like, I am sure while the meals might have been horrifying at his house because his brother was being made to eat like a dog, it was something that his mother consistently prepared. Yeah. And maybe that was a memory he could go back to.
And even when Dominic is describing Dessa, a woman that he really loved, it's obvious that he really put her on a pedestal in a way that doesn't really signify the type of love that I think makes a sustainable relationship. Mm-hmm. Because thinking someone's like a perfect angel isn't seeing them. And I think everyone wants to be fundamentally seen. Mm-hmm. And, he really idolizes Dessa in a way that makes, especially when he tells the story of their marriage dissolving, I think even though he's the one telling it from his side, it's incredibly, it was obvious to me why Dessa had to leave and should have left. So it was, like you said, really gratifying to see him like open up a little to Dr. Patel and ask her about her life. And this, you know, doctor with grandchildren seems to be a really interesting, wonderful person.
Yeah.
That seems like a hopeful place to end, you know, with Dominic maybe trying to open up. This was lovely. I think next time, the next 15 chapters, does that seem reasonable?
Yeah, that sounds great.
That's our show for the week. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Dana Schwartz, and you can find me on Twitter at Dana Schwartz with 3 Z's. You can follow Jennifer Wright at Jen Ashley Wright. Karama Donkwa is at Karama Drama. Melissa Hunter is at Melissa FTW. And Tian Tran is smart enough to have gotten off Twitter, but she is on Insta at Hank Tina. Our executive producer is Christopher Hesiodis, and we're produced and edited by Mike Johns. Next week, we'll go further into the heart of darkness of I Know This Much Is True.
It does feel like human atrocity bingo. It felt like Wally was like, how do we make this even more fucked up?
Oh, what do we think the prize is for human atrocity bingo?
Oh,
God. I think a nap. I think a long daytime nap.
Yes.
Popcorn Book Club is a production of iHeartRadio.
Hi, I'm Michael Rappaport.
And I'm Kibi Rappaport.
And together we're hosting Rappaport's Reality Podcast.
We have a passion for reality TV, and we're inviting you into our living room.
We're dissecting the drama, and we're giving praise to the single greatest form of entertainment on television today. That is right. Reality TV is the greatest form of entertainment on television today.
Listen to Rappaport's Reality with me, Kibi Rappaport.
And me, Michael Rappaport, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go, right? There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. On NPR's new podcast, Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's part existential deep dive and part game show. I ask actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to ask some of life's biggest questions. Listen to NPR's Wildcard on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, this is Kurtwood Smith. You remember me from such TV comedies as That 70s Show and That 90s Show on Netflix. I'll never forget the words that my grandfather said just before he kicked the bucket. He said, "Watch how far I can kick this bucket." People ask me where I get my dad jokes from. I tell them to listen to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast. Listen to Daily Dad Jokes every day on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.